The book of Proverbs is a fairly easy read, except that you need to pause and think about what it's saying. One theory is that it was written for children, to give them some basic guidelines for living. Here and there, you may be tempted to disagree with them, but in the run-up to Advent this year, we're going to be looking at 10. All very different, all very informative, all very challenging. We're not unfamiliar with Proverbs. You probably grew up with some yourself. I tried saying some of the Jamaican ones, but figured out that you'd be laughing at me, not the proverb. Around the world, proverbs run into hundreds, probably thousands. Here are a few. See if you can guess which one's in the Bible. A bad workman blames his tools. Stitch in time saves nine. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Actions speak louder than words. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. Cheese, wine and friends must be old to be good. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. A quarrelsome wife is like the constant dripping of a leaky roof in a rainstorm. That one is actually in the book of Proverbs, chapter 27 and verse 15. So let's read from Proverbs 10, verses 11 to 16 this morning. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers over all wrongs. Wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of one who has no sense. The wise store up knowledge, but the mouth of a fool invites ruin. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. The wages of the righteous is life, but the earnings of the wicked are sin and death. And we're having a look at verse 12. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers over all wrongs. So let's start by thinking a bit about conflict. They say that the main causes of conflict are competing goals, different philosophies, and contrasting personality types. Proverbs just puts it down to hatred. I suppose the common denominator is that we don't readily take to people who are not like us. And that can be for all kinds of reasons. First of all, cultural. There's always been a bit of a tension between the English and the Scottish. Scotland wants its independence now, and many English are happy to cut them loose. I suppose there's a lot of deep-seated history behind it. But then it seems like all neighbouring countries don't like each other, and their borders tell a story. I've had numerous conversations with Hungarians who don't like Romanians, Lithuanians who don't like Russians. We had a group of Romanian men squatting under the awning at the front of the church for a long time. And when a group of drunken Polish people heard it, they looked at me sympathetically and rolled their eyes. The British assume that Canadians are from the US, while the Americans assume that anyone with a Canadian accent is British. You'll have to tell me how it is between the Caribbean islands. Any opportunity for a dig, and we tend to seize it. More seriously, the tensions between Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda, or Sinhalese and Tamils in Sri Lanka, have led to appalling violence. When I was a kid, they used to talk about there being a Christian revival in Rwanda, but by 1994, the majority Hutu population had turned on the minority Tutsis, and in the space of 100 days, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Tutsis died. Even moderate Hutus were slaughtered. Nothing can turn back the clock, but stories did emerge. There was a man who killed a woman's father and three brothers, and then later sought her forgiveness. She gave it. He helped to build her a new home with a covered roof. There was another story of a Hutu death squad coming to a small Catholic school where there was a single teacher and 12 girls. Some girls Hutu and some Tutsi. The leader of the death squad told the Hutu girls to step forward so they could be spared, but nobody moved. And so they came to the first girl, who happened to be a Hutu, and demanded to know which tribe she belonged to. "I am a Rwandan," she replied, and the other girls followed her lead. In angry frustration, the soldiers battered them all to death. But after they were captured and interrogated, one of them revealed the truth about the courage of these girls. "I am a Rwandan." Such simple words, and yet some of the most profound ever spoken. And then there's religious division. It's often said that the problem with any form of religious fundamentalism is that you think you're right and everybody else is wrong. Christianity and Islam probably have the worst track records when it comes to the suspicion, intolerance, hatred and violence that flow from their fundamentalist streams. But even the Buddhists of Myanmar overreacted to a burst of violence from the Rohingya Muslims. And Hindus, Sikhs and Jews also have blood on their hands. It's sometimes hard to know where religion ends and culture begins, but it's a reality. This year we witnessed an interesting conflict within the borough. Lockdown came at the end of March. Ramadan then started at the end of April. Ramadan is a month of prayer and fasting for Muslims, and the urgency of the call to prayer increases towards the end. However, because strict social distancing was in force, Muslims approached the mayor and asked for permission for the call to prayer to be amplified from the mosques. Permission was granted. So for a week from 15th to 23rd of May, the call went out. Sitting in the garden, it was noticeable, but not hugely disturbing. But for other faith groups, the content was disturbing. The call is in Arabic, so you may not have noticed, but the words are very exclusive. God is great. I bear witness that there is no God except Allah. I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. I think what annoyed a number of people was not so much the fact that 19 mosques were given permission to broadcast this message, but that the council so readily acceded to their request. It seemed to reinforce the perception that certain faiths get special privileges. Now, there's a delicate balance to be struck here, and religious conflict is never far from the surface. Council could have done things better, and no doubt lessons have been learned following the stream of complaints and correspondence. But a more sinister danger is always lurking. We Christians are in danger of labelling people by their religious affiliation and not seeing them as unique and special individuals. From such superficiality, conflict finds soil in which to grow. Light must overcome darkness. And then from culture and religion, we go to personality, because we're all different. In the old days, they used to talk about the various temperaments or humours, sanguine, choleric, phlegmatic, melancholic. They tended to blur into each other, but they were trying to distinguish between people who were measured or impulsive, people who were doers or thinkers. Nowadays, the personality charts are more nuanced. Some use Enneagrams, others Myers-Briggs. As with all these things, they're great for labelling other people, but not quite thorough enough for labelling me. And therein lies the problem. We understand our own complexity and are therefore very forgiving of ourselves, but we don't understand the complexity of others, and we're less forgiving of them. I'm sure you can think of people, managers who are so focused on the urgency of the job that they forget that their staff need to get some sleep occasionally. People who have a great pay ethic but not a great work ethic. Colleagues who take sickies and are oblivious to the extra work they're piling on others. We had a holiday with some friends a few years ago and flew out early in the morning on the Friday before half term. Along with others on the flight, we'd hired a car, and while we were waiting, one of the other passengers who was sitting there with his wife and kids rang his sister in the UK asking her to phone the school and tell them his daughter was sick. I understood that flying before half term helped to make the holiday a lot cheaper, but I struggled with a brazen lack of integrity, especially as the girl was listening to her father tell a barefaced lie. For all sorts of reasons, you will find certain people annoying, and sometimes that annoyance will spill over into words. The trouble with words is that you can't take them back, whereas you can keep your thoughts to yourself and work at bringing them under control. So the sources of human conflict are varied. But let me say something briefly about hatred. There's a story in the book of Genesis about Esau and Jacob, the sons of Isaac. They were twins, but they were very different in appearance, and Esau was the older of the two. You may recall the story of how Esau sold his birthright to his brother, and then how later Jacob tricked his father into blessing him rather than his brother. All of this fulfilled an oracle when the two were born, that the older would serve the younger. Now, what's interesting is some words from the prophet Malachi, which are quoted by Paul in Romans 9, verse 13. Paul is reflecting on God's dealings with Israel, and in particular, this difficult question of election or predestination. Expressed in very personal terms, did I choose God or did he choose me? Predestination and free will is a popular topic for debate among Christians. Anyway, in this context, Paul quotes Malachi's words, "Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated." It's strong language, isn't it? It suggests unfairness, bias. Surely God doesn't hate anyone, and clearly there's more than meets the eye in that word hated. God undoubtedly chose Jacob to further his purposes, not because he was more upright than Esau, but for his own inscrutable reasons. And clearly it gave rise to conflict within the family. The Bible is struggling to find language that does justice to God's decisions, and love and hate are what we're given. In the context, it refers to Jacob being given preferential treatment, and discrimination is bound to give rise to conflict. There's a complicated stuff to discuss here, and no time to do it in a short sermon, maybe the home groups later. And so finally, let's come to love. The proverb says, love covers over all wrongs. That's nice, because we're not just talking about differences now, but wrongs. In the New Testament, Peter picks up on the proverb and says, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Gardens can be very messy places with old junk lying around, but when it snows and everything has a light covering, suddenly what's ugly can seem beautiful. Now, hostility is commonplace, sometimes provided for our entertainment, but sometimes real. Jesus' story about neighbourliness is important. You need to be aware that there was a lot of antagonism between Jews and Samaritans. They had a common history and lived next door to each other, but Jews saw Samaritans as people who had sold out and despised them accordingly. So in the story, a travelling Jew gets beaten up. Two other Jews see him lying there and walk on by, but a despised Samaritan stops and does the neighbourly thing. You would have expected the Samaritan to walk on by, but thankfully he is not defined by the popular label, because love doesn't allow other people to define you. And so love crosses the barriers of culture and religion and personality and seeks the other person's well-being, even has the capacity to love those who are its enemies. Father, forgive them, says a dying Jesus following a mockery of a trial and a horrendous beating. Far from creating conflict, love heals, it reconciles, it breathes new life into a contaminated human race. Love one another, said Jesus, as I have loved you. And apparently the Apostle John, the only apostle not to be martyred, and who, tradition tells us, spent his final days as part of the church in Ephesus, he distilled his teaching down to the same three words, love one another. And as you navigate this world with all its complicated issues, with all its appalling injustices, with all its sickening violence, as you see the unacceptable face of police brutality, and try to figure out if Black Lives Matter is a simple statement about equality or a Trojan horse for a resurgent Marxist ideology, as you watch the flames burning on Lesbos, as refugees reignite their struggle for a better future, and then you try to figure out the rights and wrongs of asylum and immigration policy, as you hear of yet another Novichok poisoning and watch as tyrants suppress their opponents and rise again in Russia and China. The solution is not big walls like the one on the US-Mexico border. The answer is not upping the size of the military, nor creating yet more destructive weapons. The answer is not even education, for evil people are not stupid, and the heart of every human being is more diseased than many of us realise. The answer is in that simple yet extraordinary word, love. Herein is love, wrote John, not that we love God, but that he loved us and gave his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sin. Paul wrote, God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Hate hits out, love helps out. So the choice is simple. Maybe not simple to implement, but simple enough to understand. As Paul said in perhaps his greatest love song, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.